The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast,
there's an undercurrent of panic.
We discuss the climate wars.
I would say probably a majority of the interviews I did with scientists in the UK, in the US, in Germany and so on, probably Russia, and they don't quite know what to do.
A grim prediction of what will happen if governments continue to ignore environmental degradation.
And that's certainly what the soldiers think. Now, that's perhaps a professional deformation on their part. That's the sort of thing they're trained to think. But sometimes they are right, and this may be one of the times.
We explore mind-altering drugs.
It's a massive opium pipe.
It's nothing new, but at the same time, it's constantly new. Every culture seems to have a different relationship with drugs.
You could look at it straight, you could look at it stoned. They had to bring their own head to it.
And why some parts of science are just too difficult to explain.
Time to time, we bump into things that are just too dense. You know, like there's a lot of physics that I'm just not interested in.
Plus, why not curl up with the Guardian Science Book Club?
There is a lot there to enjoy. I mean, it's not badly written either. It's better than Geoffrey Archer.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. We've got a couple of non-British voices in the pod today to liven things up. First up is Gwyn Dyer. He's a freelance journalist and broadcaster. His column on international affairs is published in more than 175 papers across 45 countries. An Academy Award nominee as well, no less. A first for this podcast, I think. He's here today to talk about his new book, Climate Wars. Plus, we've got Tim Radford, former science editor at The Guardian, winner of four awards from the Association of British Science Writers. We're going to talk about your involvement in The Guardian Science Book Club a bit later in the programme. But first, let's hear about how the world as we know it will descend into chaos. We talk about the science of climate change all the time on this podcast, but Gwyn Dyer's new book, Climate Wars, is all about the human impacts of the coming changes. There will be physical effects on the Earth, for sure, but also in the way we live, on diplomacy, politics, and on war. Gwyn, your book starts off with a scenario of the world in 2045. Russia is a superpower, the EU's collapsed. Just take us through that scenario, and then we'll talk about how you got to it.
The assumption is that you've got about 2 degrees of warming by then, 2 degrees Celsius above, let's say, 1990 levels. Which is not all that drastic. Actually, subsequently, the Hadley Center in the west of England gave out a prediction last November that we might be at 4 degrees by the 2050s. But let's go with 2 degrees in 2045. The principal impact is, of course, on the food supply. There just isn't enough in many countries to go around. The closer you are to the equator, the worse off you are. So countries as far north as Britain can probably still feed themselves. Countries closer, even around the Mediterranean, Italy, Spain, probably cannot. And there's no international grain market because most of the exporting countries are out of the business. And therefore, countries are starting to go hungry. And that sets up a series of essentially north-south conflicts between countries that have enough and countries that don't have enough. This is what the military in a number of countries are looking at now, and that's actually what got me started on this. So, for example, you would probably see very severe damage in China. And refugees heading north. The Russians are already deeply paranoid about this. But, if the Chinese suffer the kind of loss of food supply that they're likely to, and I think this is why the Chinese government's so frightened quietly, then you're probably looking at a revolution civil war.
In that specific part of the world, can you take us through why this might be happening? If the world is warming, then Russia, North Russia becomes more habitable, you can grow more grain there. Is that the idea?
Well, they think that's the idea, but it probably doesn't work that way. If you look at what actually happened this past summer in Russia, that's more likely to be the future. They're facing it 2 or 3 degrees hotter, which is, peat fires, crops withering in the fields, and a ban on on grain exports, which is what we've got now as a result of a summer that was way beyond the ordinary. But those won't be beyond the ordinary. However, they'll probably still be able to feed themselves. Whereas in China, for example, you will see by the mid-2040s almost certainly the glaciers that feed the great rivers of China will have melted. They're going fairly fast. Chinese Academy of Sciences says 7% a year. They're fairly low glaciers, so they're in a relatively warm part of the world. They're on the edge of the Tibetan Plateau. And once they're gone, the great rivers of southern China are seasonal. They don't have much water in them in the summertime, which is actually when you want it for rice paddy. So there goes rice paddy agriculture in South China. The wheat-growing areas of North China depend on the northeast monsoon, which has already been weakening for 20 years and is predicted to weaken more and more with growing temperatures. And, in fact, just this past summer, the Chinese government started advising farmers in the North Chinese plain to start growing potatoes instead of wheat, because it takes less water. And finally, there's a series of east-facing river deltas, very flat, at the mouths of the major Chinese rivers, which in even a half meter of sea level rise, with typhoons roaring in off the Pacific, will inundate those deltas if it happens at high tide. You know, so all of China's food resources are hit at the same time. There is a story circulating. The World Bank did give out a series of contracts on how much food supply various countries would lose at 2 degrees higher. I happened to stumble across the person in the think tank in Delhi who did that one for India, and they said 25%. I then tried to find out what the one in Beijing said. It's never been published, of course. The World Bank is sitting on all these, the results of all these contracts. But the answer was somebody did put up the executive summary on a website for one day, and the loss is 38% at 2 degrees hotter. Well, revolution and civil war, and refugees pouring north into Russia, and so on. The Australians see the same thing happening in reverse, so to speak. Refugees pouring north out of south out of Indonesia and the Philippines. The European Union, quite quietly, sees a problem arising not just with the southern shore of the Mediterranean, but later on with the northern shore of the Mediterranean. Now, this is very difficult. You can't actually have this discussion with all the members of the European Union in the room, so to speak, because it's about Spain and Italy and Greece and the southern Balkans and what happens to those countries at 2 or 3 degrees hotter. And the answer is nothing good. And no doubt we'll try to keep them where they are by giving them food from the resources of northern Europe. But, at some point, I suspect the free movement within the European Union will come to a halt.
Tim, Gwyn's book takes us through many scenarios like this, and they're all slightly nightmarish. They are all about the political ramifications of what many people might think of in terms of climate change as being just things affecting the world. They're not affecting me. They're not affecting countries. How much is this part of the thinking of scientists, politicians, military people already?
These conclusions have been there to be drawn for at least 20 years, and some people did actually start trying to point out that this was the inevitable consequence of a warming world. One of the things that Gwyn hasn't stressed, although it's there in his book for anyone who wants to read it, is that a 2 degree warming is not actually a 2 degree warming. That is, you won't just be 2 degrees warmer every day. You'll be quite normal. You won't notice the difference for quite a lot of the time, and then you'll get a heat wave. And that will be absolutely catastrophic. It'll be catastrophic at every point in the life cycle of the plants you depend on, and, of course, for the creatures around you, and for the people who have to live in cities without air conditioning.
This isn't just about melting glaciers and rising sea levels.
It's about actual physical suffering on the ground for people who are exposed to this. What Gwyn has done, and I will now do a bit of plugging here, is he's actually taken a story that was there all the time and made it fresh. He's done something which I've always thought was a bit dangerous. It's a reporter's book. That is, a reporter has gone out and done some reporting. And that never quite makes a good book. But this time, because he's actually used the scenario story, he's taken the responsibility for the scenario himself. He's made it into a drama, and he's just gone out and talked to somebody whose credentials are so stupefyingly solid, and then heard the same story from them. Well, so the advisors to Obama, the Navy Analysis Center, Schellnhuber from the Potsdam Institute, are all telling the same story, of course, as scientists, that is, with pursed lips and fingertips together in a calm sort of way. But it comes alive. And, of course, that raises the next question. Why do we have a polarized planet in which there are people who actually genuinely think this is a conspiracy of 30,000 climate scientists who just want more grant money?
There's an undercurrent of panic in a number, I would say probably a majority, of the interviews I did with scientists in the UK, in the US, in Germany, and so on, probably Russia. They don't quite know what to do. I mean, you know, because again, if they can't even get out and preach because it will undermine their scientific status, and yet they can see this thing coming at them like a freight train.
The most conservative scientists who attended the 1988 Toronto conference in 20 years ago, 22 years ago, this was the one at which they decided to have an IPCC, an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They were then cautious. All the people who were cautious then are now much more expressively worried than the wildest campaigners were 20 years ago. All the things that campaigners warned us about now seem like, well, rather comfortable, really. I jokingly predicted that in a climate change situation, there would be some people who would win, but they wouldn't be able to make money out of it. I said, I think, that the conditions for growing champagne to a perfect level would move north to Hamburg, and who would buy sparkling Hamburg? I'm astonished to find that English sparkling wine is now charging champagne prices, and it's happened imperceptibly.
Well, some of the conclusions in your book, you pour cold water on the idea that actually personal behaviour can do very much to solve this. So, you know, putting in, you know, energy-saving light bulbs, driving cars less, taking fewer flights. I mean, I don't think you're arguing that these things are completely useless and that people shouldn't do them.
No.
But what's your larger point there? Is it that it's governments?
The larger point
that
is that you
this?
Have to change how you generate your energy. Cutting the use of energy is going to win you a little bit more time to achieve that goal of changing the way you generate energy, getting out of fossil fuels. But if you don't get out of fossil fuels, then sooner or later, and it may be sooner, you are actually going to lose control of the climate entirely. We have to stop using them. Now, you know, cutting wins you time. That's all it does.
Growing biofuels, for instance, it doesn't help at all, because you're then taking away land that is desperately needed for food. And so you could create a famine simply by trying to have innocent petrol for your car. So that we actually really do have to change our ways. And there's never been any other choice. I mean, people have talked about geoengineering, but if we get to that, then we've lost already.
Ah, but Gwyn, you say geoengineering is not an option. You have to do it.
I think it will be resorted to. I am less confident that it will be effective, but matters will get so desperate that some countries will be prepared to try. My candidate for number one would be China, unless the Bangladeshis beat them to it, because, you know, the countries that are in the deepest trouble are the ones who are going to want to do this first.
Have you got any particular technologies which you think should be tested out as soon as possible? I mean, the Royal Society, when it came out with a report on geoengineering a year ago, said that, you know, this should be a plan B, but it should be a plan B that's had some testing, because none of these things have been tested.
Absolutely. I mean, none of these techniques have been tested in the open air.
Have any sort of priorities amongst the various geoengineering ideas?
The leading technique suggested originally 3 or 4 years ago, the leading candidate, I should say, suggested by a scientist called Paul Crutzen, who got a Nobel Prize for his work in atmospheric chemistry, so I think we have to pay attention to the man, suggested, look, we're not going to manage to stop this warming before we get into runaway, plus 2 degrees, and therefore what I propose is that we put a sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, above the weather, so it stays out, well, you know, where the planes fly, so it doesn't rain out, it'll stay there a long time. Doesn't have to be a large volume if you're not having to replenish it all the time, but it will reflect enough incoming sunlight, 1 or 2%, to lower the temperature at the surface and keep us under that 2-degree threshold we must not cross. Another one, which it would be quite simple to test, It's actually a British scientist, a fellow called John Latham, that he now works in Colorado, in Boulder, where the Americans do their climate work. And his idea is that we could actually thicken the clouds near the ocean surface. By spraying up a fine mist of seawater, you'd build a little fleet of remote-controlled, unmanned, wind-powered vessels, and they just spray seawater into the air about 10 meters, and there is a layer of low-lying cloud that covers a lot of the ocean, marine stratocumulus cloud, if you're into that sort of thing, which is only about 100 meters up. So convection, you know, turbulence will carry a lot of that mist into the clouds where it will stick, thicken the clouds, they reflect more sunlight. These are techniques that you could test in a local way, and the happy thing about the second of them is you can turn it off right away, which you can't with the sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere. But test it and see what... There will be unwelcome side effects. Almost any large-scale intervention has them, but let's figure out what they are.
Why don't we wind up with maybe some positive messages in that case? I mean, the world government's coming together...
I'll leave you to do that, Tim.
Well, I was hoping for both of you, actually, but the world government's coming together in Cancun in less than a month. This is obviously 1 year after the... Not very good, not very useful Copenhagen talks. It's another UN talk. Gwyn, what possibly could come out of this that you would sort of raise a cheer about?
Nothing at all. No, I'm sorry, it can't be done
at all.
I mean, I'm not saying that these negotiations are forever doomed, but it's too soon after that train wreck at Copenhagen for people to have got their act together and return with a serious proposition.
What about more of an acknowledgement of the kinds of problems you raise in the book?
Oh, they've done that. I mean, one of the things that happened in the last year, it sort of almost slipped by unnoticed, all the governments on the planet have signed up to a commitment, no ways of achieving it defined, but a commitment not to let average global temperature rise above 2 degrees Celsius, ever. Now, what that means is that they understand, even if they won't say it in front of the children, that after that we go into runaway warming. You lose control. Until then, we can turn off the emissions, and therefore we are, in a sense, in control of the warming. After that, you've triggered natural sources of carbon dioxide like melting permafrost, which you can't turn off, and you're into runaway. So they know. The governments know. But the problem which makes the negotiations so extremely difficult is the history problem. I mean, Tim was talking about who, you know, digging up 200 years of you know, Cretaceous or Carboniferous sunshine. Who dug it up? It wasn't everybody. It was, in fact, about 8 or 9 large countries and a few smaller ones, all of them in the Northern Hemisphere. Japan, Russia, China, Japan, Russia, America, Canada, Britain, France, Germany. These are the countries who did
it. The
total population of all those countries is about 1 billion, 1/7 of the world's population. But we have dumped the whole planet in the mess. There's only one atmosphere. So they want a deal that recognizes that. Their commitments will not be the same as ours in any global deal. I imagine, and most of the people at Copenhagen, if you really pushed them up against a wall and threatened them with a knife, would have said, here's the deal I think we might get if we ever got a deal. And it would be that the developed countries agree to cut their emissions very steeply, quickly, up front, 20%, 30% cuts in emissions in 10 years. The developing countries, especially the rapidly developing ones, China, India, Brazil, they agree to cap their emissions where they are now and not cut them because they're still way below our level of emissions per capita, and they haven't been doing it for the last 200 years. But they still want to grow their economies. And in order to grow their economies, they've got to increase their energy output. So now they've got to do it without burning fossil fuels. It's more expensive. Who pays the difference? We do. That's the deal. But you can't sell it to Western electorates. I mean, you can't.
No, this is the problem for politicians always face, that they will get no credit for disasters that don't happen. So there's not a lot in it for them to avert a disaster. I'd like just like to come back onto the military point of you can't run an army on a windmill. You can't have solar panels all over the place on your tanks. You actually have to have fossil fuels. If we have to resort to making armaments and throwing them at people, then we've lost anyway.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there before it becomes too depressing. Gwyn Dyer's book, Climate Wars, is available now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, go to @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, just follow @GuardianScience. Still to come on this podcast...
Hello, hello. Testing, testing, testing.
Jad from WNYC's Radio Lab.
It's sort of a science show for poets.
Next, we're going to talk about getting high.
Science Weekly.
Cocaine eye drops, intoxicated spiders, and literature written after an opium dream. Just some of the things on display in a new London exhibition. Producer Andy went along to the Wellcome Collection to expand his mind, although he insists that no free samples were on offer.
We have two overheads that are kind of representing the liquid projection that is the kind of the basis of the psychedelic light show from the 60s.
I'm Joshua White, and I am a survivor of the 60s and was the designer and the director of the Joshua Light Show at the Fillmore East in New York in 1968, 69, 70. This is associated with drugs in to the degree that the job of the Joshua Light Show at the Fillmore East was to provide a strong visual stimulus, something that was comparable to the music of the time, which was Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane. But there was nothing to look at, and the light show provided them with stimulation. And they had to bring their own head to it, was the term we used to use. They'd bring their own head to it, which simply meant you could look at it straight, you could look at it stoned, you know, you could do anything you wanted. And the audience very much appreciated that because they would all see something different in the light show. It was designed to be stimulating rather than specific.
These little juglets were used for transporting opium around the Mediterranean area about 2,500 years ago. Hello, I'm Caroline Fisher from the Wellcome Collection. I'm one of the curators of High Society. It's really about the idea that drugs are a universal thing that occur throughout the world in different cultures, and there's a huge range of substances, that some of which we don't even think of as drugs at all, like coffee and alcohol. But then also the ones that are heavily controlled, such as heroin, cocaine, cannabis, which, looking back in time, have at times been perfectly legal and available over the counter in your high street pharmacy.
What doth the little crocodile improve his shining tail and pour the waters of the Nile on every golden scale?
So we have another little complex of stuff here around Alice in Wonderland, where we have the section of the caterpillar eating the mushroom, describing the strange effects on sort of size and distance and proportion that it produces. And we've got that together with a Victorian book of drugs which explains these effects, and which Lewis Carroll presumably got his material from. And also here on the screen, Jonathan Miller's film of Alice in Wonderland from 1966. Hi, I'm Mike Jay, and I'm one of the curators of the High Society exhibition, and I've written the book that goes along with it.
I've just taken some drugs before I've come in here this morning, like a cup of coffee, I ought to add to make it clear, but they've been doing it for generations. It goes back hundreds, thousands of years.
I mean, your cup of coffee, for example, would have been illegal in Germany a few centuries ago. You know, your tobacco, you know, in Russia was illegal. We all remember that alcohol was prohibited in the States last century. So, most of the drugs that we use in our culture, which are kind of invisible to us as drugs, we don't think of them as drugs because they're around all the time, but you know, in other times and places those were illegal, and our illegal drugs today are ones that were kind of much more widely used and much less controversial at other times and places.
Well, I'm feeling perfectly fit at the moment, as sane as I ever am, and I'll take the drug now.
Our society today seems deeply worried, deeply troubled by what is happening with the consumption of drugs, and maybe particularly with the marketing of drugs, with the production and sale of drugs, the distribution.
I want you to take away 7 from 100 and go on taking it away until there's nothing left.
Well, I don't know if it was right. If it was right, it was good.
It wasn't too right, it wasn't too good, but it doesn't matter here at this point.
I'm Ken Arnold, and I run the public programs here at Wellcome Collection. Well, this is one of the numerous bits of contemporary art, and art, of course, has been deeply influenced by drugs. Much art has been produced under the influence of drugs. This is by Rodney Graham. It's a reflection of the story of the initial discovery, the invention, if you like, of LSD. This exhibition is not trying to say here's an answer to these problems, but I suppose to point out that it's a universal phenomena, and that a lot of science, but also a lot of politics, a lot of social thinking can be poured into this subject.
High Society runs until February. For more details, go to wellcomecollection.org. There's also a link to that on our Facebook group. Search for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. Now, we're going to cross all the way over to Studio 4 now to producer Andy with our next piece.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Quick bit level.
Testing.
Yeah, I think we're on. I'm here with Fran, one of the other audio producers here at The Guardian.
Hello, Andy.
Hi there. Now, you've just been to the States.
I have.
Why?
I went to the Third Coast Festival in Chicago, which is a conference for audio lovers. Network with them and also learn a few things about how to produce programmes.
Very geeky. Now, you met someone pretty interesting.
I met my hero.
Who's that?
Oh, Jad Abumrad.
The presenter and, in fact, no, he calls himself the host because he's American. He's the host and producer of Radiolab.
WNYC and NPR.
You're listening to Radiolab.
For those who don't know what Radiolab is.
Yeah, I always have trouble with that one because it's, I hope, a program that will always remain difficult to describe. But it's like we're sitting at some kind of surreal diner.
Let's just do it. You're going to do it?
Okay.
Let's just freaking do it. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radio Lab, the podcast.
And we're talking about things that interest us, ideas that we find fascinating. Except the rules of this diner are that every time you think something, it's there. You know, you have a thought bubble that goes, and suddenly you're in some kind of theatrical scenario. Suddenly you turn to the right, and there is a scientist doing something utterly fascinating. And you turn to him, and you ask him questions. And then you turn back to each other and you discuss. And then some waitress comes and abuses you for talking too loud. And then there's music and theater and happening, but it's all sort of, it's built around this idea of two people talking who are intensely curious about the world, who just want to know how things work. And we want to sort of, I mean, we're interested in science, but it's not simply science. It's science that sort of leads you step by step to these moments of wonder where you can think philosophically about the world. I don't know if that at all conveys anything, what I just said. But, I mean, I've heard it called a science show, which, you know, I mean, if I had the elevator and all I had was 10 seconds, I'd say it's kind of a science show, but it really isn't. It's sort of a science show for poets, I would say. That'd be my sort of pithy description.
No, it's very production heavy.
Now, there's something wrong with the sound recording here, or what was it?
Yes. Well, you can hear my voice was going by then, but what I was trying to ask him was if there were any science subjects that he felt he couldn't cover. We can't do this on Radiolab.
Well, we time to time we bump into things that are just too dense. You know, like there's a lot of physics that I'm just not interested in. And I want to be interested in it, but it feels so far away and so abstract and so theoretical that, I mean, I know part of the challenge a lot of the time with the science is that you're dealing with stuff that's very intentionally inhuman. I mean, like, scientists try and remove the humanity out of what they're doing so that they can be unbiased, they can be rigorous. What we're always trying to do is kind of pull it back in, kicking and screaming. But there are some topics where you just can't. I mean, we've tried a variety of stories on nuances of genetics, and it's really freaking hard, and you have to work really hard just to capture just a little bit of wonder, and then that can be so. Yeah, there are areas that we've not gone into very much. I've been very interested in epigenetics recently, It's just hard, though. It's hard, like dealing with genes, dealing with the way that genes interact with layers on top of them, which interact with the environment. It's hard to make that feel like a little short story, just how it needs to feel for me.
What? Tell me.
Okay, you blinked.
Oh.
Is about. Do you ever wonder?
I know this about blinks. This is interesting.
What?
When you blink,
you don't intentionally avoid it. It's just somehow you can't get it.
So we have a science podcast, and
I mean, I guess for me, the real challenge is to do the Hadron Collider in a Radiolab style. I asked him if that would be possible for him.
Yeah, you know, we're doing a story right now about particle physics, and it's a really interesting story. I mean, it's about how at the very beginning of the universe you had this soup that consisted of all these particles, but we also know it consisted of antiparticles as well. So you had an electron, but an anti-electron. And the two would come together and they would blow up. So you had like half of this soup is matter and half of it was antimatter, and they kept coming together and blowing up. And so you're like, how the hell are we here? You know? It's a really deep question, and we're working really hard to make it work, but there's something about particle physics that just feels intangible to me. I can't touch it. I can't somehow understand it through the experience of a human being. It's all kind of in this imagined universe, which I'm sure exists on some level, but I don't have a big imagination when it comes to that kind of stuff. You know, I think part of the reason that Radiolab works is because I don't have an imagination. I try very, very hard to hear it. I don't want to imagine it. I want it to be right there in my ears.
He's actually a composer as well as a science presenter. So I was kind of interested to find out from him whether he saw science as a sound itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use sound, I think, in my life as a lens through which to see the ideas. Not just sound itself, but I mean, sound can be a metaphor for so many things. One of the fun things is to find sound ways to metaphorically express very complicated things, very poetic things, very spiritual things. I feel like can be moved and can be explained through sound, because sound is a force. It touches you, it vibrates, and it's physical. And for me, a lot of the times there's this question of how to make something that is abstract physical, and sound is this shorthand. It actually reaches across space and touches you, and I find the simple act of that always beautiful. You know, it's the sort of thing that I wake up in the morning excited to do, is make sound.
Perfect. Okay, that's great.
Tim Radford, we're going to come back to you now just before we finish the program. We ought to have a quick chat about the Guardian Science Book Club. This has been your baby for the last year or so. You've been reading a book a month and asking readers to sort of do the same and then comment on them. The next one you're going to be talking about is a bit of a celebrity in the science circuit, Colin Pillinger. For those who don't know who Colin Pillinger is, and I can't imagine as many, tell us who he is and why he came to prominence.
The word charismatic might have been invented for him. He was one of the most entertaining, likable scientists ever to stalk the halls of the Royal Society. He was also a great fun, and he was a scientist, and there are many such, who actually tended to get on rather well with the press, and not for any reason except that he sort of quite liked us.
He's a space scientist.
He was involved in the Apollo program, although the moon rock study program. He's written a book which is I will say it now, it's not a good book in the literary sense. It's not even a good book in the clear storytelling sense, but it's still extraordinary, riveting. For those of us who've lived through Beagle 2, which was Britain's only attempt to do something serious in space in the last, since 1968, I think. I can't remember quite when we put up Black Arrow and Ariel. But that was Britain's last great gesture. And then we said, who cares about space? It's not important, which was the most foolish decision that didn't spill any blood that a British government has ever taken. Well, it's taken lots of others.
The US government got to the moon and basically decided the same thing.
It came to the same thing. In fact, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. Spiro T. Agnew, who was Richard Nixon's vice president, predicted that we would be on Mars by 1984. And The Economist, I think, predicted that the first baby would be born in space on an orbiting space platform before 2000.
The Economist is always right about this sort of thing. There's probably has been a baby born, we just don't know. the Beagle 2 was, as you say, Britain's attempt to just land something on Mars and try and find evidence of life. And we don't know what happened to it. I mean, it must have crash landed on Boxing Day. When was it? 2005?
Christmas morning.
Christmas morning, and everyone was up looking for this thing. The thing that Colin Pillinger did was, first of all, he built it, but he involved a whole bunch of sort of people who wouldn't normally be expected to be involved in space missions, and got everyone to support it, the country to support it. I mean, that's the story that's being told in this book that he's written.
That's true. What he did was rather like that character in Little Dorrit who tries to make something happen and get the Circumlocution Department to act. And many, many scientists have tried this before, but Pillinger actually did it. He built a lander that you could fold up into a dustbin lid, and then you could stick it into a tiny spare space in a European mission that was going to Mars anyway. And then, as it got to Mars, it opened its doors and threw this little blighter out, and a very subtle, very clever, beautifully designed, miniaturized instrument was going to land on Mars and then drill a hole and then poke a little sniffer down and actually look for evidence of organic material at some point in Martian history. We don't expect anything to be alive on Mars now because of the conditions under which a thin atmosphere, freeze, terrible cold, a violent abrasion, and no water. But underneath, surely, there may be something. And the discovery of life on Mars or life outside this planet would really be it would be such a scientific trophy. It would change our attitude to the universe around us. It would raise questions that have nagged away all through our literature.
Well, those questions are still nagging. Beagle 2 never called home, did it?
Well, it
was thrown into the Martian atmosphere, and then
what went wrong is something that we can't now possibly say. There wasn't enough redundancy built in. That is, when you do engineering things like this, you have to have safety margins that accommodate all possible contingencies, and in the space of a dustbin lid, there wasn't that kind of buffering.
Okay, well, if any listeners out there want to read this book, it's called My Life on Mars, The Beagle 2 Diaries by Colin Pillinger, and it'll be available, well, Tim will be available to talk about that book on the Guardian Science Book Club in the coming weeks. Just go to guardian.co.uk/science for more information on all of that. That's it for this week. Thanks to Gwyn Dyer, whose book Climate Wars is out now. Thanks also to Tim Radford. Next week,
Michael Ebis at Glastonbury.
He'll be talking to us about something other than large music festivals for a change.
It's so easy to get £500,000 for this scheme.
Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk, and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
Yeehaw!
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.